Hello and welcome to The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. You may also want to join our new social medium, pieville.net. Pieville.net. Today we're going to conclude Chapter 5 of Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy with Diaspora Peoples, which we already covered. That was the preface, or double preface, as this is the paperback edition. Anyway, conclude talking about, or picking up with, the subtitle, Resource Competition Between Jews and Gentiles in Europe Following Jewish Emancipation, which around the time of Napoleon, they gave them civil rights, made them full citizens. Before, they had been in ghettos, as largely out of their own desire as much as anything. That's lied about by them as persecution down the line, because history is something Jews invent. It's basically fiction that serves current propaganda purposes, so they rewrite it as needed. There's no objective accuracy or interest in truth in Jews. They're a race of liars. That's the big takeaway from everything we do in our audiobooks in our learning college as concerns Jews. Anyway, what we're going to do, page 188 to 209 today, as I said, the conclusion of Chapter 5. So let's get into it. Resource competition between Jews and Gentiles in Europe following Jewish emancipation. The post-Enlightenment period generally ended the formal alliances between Jews and Gentile elites so characteristic of traditional societies, where they're working with the kings and collecting taxes and doing other services for fees, and a middle layer between the peasants, the agricultural people typically, and the noblemen or elites or kings. So the post-Enlightenment period generally ended that sort of alliance between Jews and Gentile elites so characteristic of traditional societies. Nevertheless, as indicated in Chapter 4, this did not end de facto Jewish separatism. And the evidence provided below indicates that Jewish-Gentile resource competition continued and perhaps actually increased during this period. Jews, said MacDonald, had a very powerful advantage in this competition. As indicated by the data presented in Chapter 7, which we haven't got to yet, Jews, because of their long history of eugenic practices and emphasis on education, were uniquely suited to upward mobility in the newly developing industrial economies of the period. Sorkin makes the interesting point, and again, I'm leaving out the page references. Get the book if you want the scholarly references. We'll read the footnotes that are good, but I'm not going to give you 1987-108. It's just too intrusive. Sorkin, S-O-R-K-I-N, makes the interesting point that the German advocates of Jewish emancipation envisioned Jews as fitting into an agrarian society by entering, quote, productive, unquote, occupations such as farming and artisanry, instead of trade and money manipulation and professional stuff. So he's saying that their entire history of uncle-niece marriages, their focus on IQ, first-cousin marriages, and their intensive Torah study prepared them, when they were loosed, to go in and dominate the professional sector. So people had delusional ideas, and they did disagree. Both people inside and outside the church disagreed about the effects of emancipation. I've said that many times and will continue to emphasize it. So you can't say the church was wrong or right, and you can't say the atheist radicals were wrong or right. Some thought Jews would, their problems with them would clear up. Others thought they would intensify. Clearly the latter were correct and the former were wrong, but it didn't break into a religious, non-religious split on that matter. So basically, people operating as a team released into a more individual, but genetically and legally individualist society, dominate it, produce all kinds of problems, which leads whites to form a counter-team called the National Socialists. And that was the first real attempt to rationally defend our people against the Jews. Has nothing specifically to do with Germany. There's lots of red herrings out there. The cuck-servatives will lie that You're not national socialists. We're socialists, like they're stupid leftists. Stupid, trivial, superficial political or economic stuff does not explain what's going on there. Now, MacDonald will tell you the Nazis were not Western. So he's more or less accepting the Catholic Church as we are the West. We created Western civilization. And the Nazis were non-Western because they were a group strategy to counter a group strategy. So white needs what I've called now a team white to counter team Jew. Because individually, and I've used the analogy or the metaphor of common carry. Common carry is a bit of a solution to the problem of black crime, but ultimately can only be addressed collectively, and that's how it is with the Jews. If they're operating as a team, and within the year of my reading this, it's been admitted from someone who studied it, yeah, they're 10 times overrepresented in the elite schools, the Ivy League, because of nepotism, not because of talent, because the actual ones who make the Phi Beta Kappa are hugely disproportionately the discriminated against whites. So Jews are using their team to get ahead and suppress others, and even to prevent others from even identifying the problem. They don't want others even able to understand what's going on, let alone do something to reverse things once they've taken power. So the history of the West has been the rise of the Jews to power over the last few hundred years. And that must be reversed. So let's continue here on page 189. Jews had a very powerful advantage in this competition because of their long history of eugenic practices and emphasis on education, and were uniquely suited to the upward mobility in the newly developing industrial economies of the period. And remember, you have the you have Napoleon and the French Revolution, and then you have giving Jews full rights in 1800, and right after that you have the Industrial Revolution starting in England and then spreading later to Germany, France, the United States, and that defines the second half of the 1800s. So now Jews have full rights, we have a lot more stuff, and we're soon to have the rise of the electronics that allow Jews to really leverage their small numbers. They already had enough leverage because they worked together, so that even a small, even a tiny minority could dominate a large majority. But now they're going to also have the amplification of electronic power and the new technical means to build national and then ultimately global networks to increase and entrench their control. That's what's going on over the last 200 years. So Sorkin makes the interesting point that the German advocates of Jewish emancipation, people who thought essentially that the Jewish problems would melt away and they'll become normal citizens, Jews are going to enter productive, quote-unquote, occupations like farming and artisanry. The hope among the pro-emancipation forces of the period was that the Jewish economic, educational, and occupational profile would be similar to that of Gentiles, so they're just going to blend in. They're going to do the same things in the same proportion others do, but of course, not the case. However, Jewish emancipation resulted in marked differences in the economic, educational, and occupational profiles of Jews and Germans. So no, they did their own thing differently. Lindemann, and I think probably in Esau's Tears, if I had to guess his reference, Lindemann, is like Albert Lindemann, I think, notes that, quote, "In the long history of the Jews, the rise of the Jews in the 19th century has few parallels in terms of the rapid transformation of the condition of the Jews in absolute and relative numbers, wealth, in fame, in power, and in influence." So the story of the 18th century was the Jewish rise to power in Europe. "The extraordinary rise of Jews in Germany in the period from 1870 to 1933 following emancipation was a general phenomenon. Jews were concentrated in urban areas and in particular occupations. In general, they were vastly overrepresented in areas requiring a high level of education. Business, professions, you know, doctors, dentists, lawyers, businessmen, traders, public service, and underrepresented in agriculture and domestic service." So they're not maids or house cleaners, farmers. They're agricultural middlemen, as they were in the U.S. South, but they're not farmers themselves. They're not producing anything. A pattern that Gordon, 1984, finds had existed since the Middle Ages. Farming is hard work and there's no real political advantage to it, as there is in these other things. In the urban, we have concentrations of power and money. In 1871, when the Jews became fully emancipated in Germany, 60% were already in the middle and upper income brackets. Moss, or Mossy, M-O-S-S-E, estimates that despite representing less than 1% of the population, Jews controlled 20% of the commercial activity in Germany in the period from 1819 to 1935, as indicated by percentages of Jews among the economic elite. Moreover, Jewish involvement in the largest companies was even more substantial than this figure might indicate. For example, Mossy finds that in 1907, Jews had a dominant position in 33 of the 100 largest companies, and in 9 of the 13 companies with share capital over 100 million marks, Jews occupied a similar position through the Weimar period. In some areas, and remember, they're not even 1% of the population, so less than in America. Thus, in the capital of Berlin, Jews accounted for nearly 45% of the official government. Kommerzienrat awards given to outstanding businessmen, and in Prussia in 1911, 44% of the 25 richest millionaires were Jews. So they're nearly half the richest millionaires in Prussia in 1911, as were 27.5% of the 200 richest millionaires and 23.7% of the 800 richest in trade and department stores. Jews also had a prominent position in private banking, so that, for example, in Berlin in 1923, there were 150 Jewish banks and 11 non-Jewish banks. That's pretty amazing. And Jews were also prominently involved in the stock market, the insurance industry, and economic consulting firms. In 1923, Jews occupied 24% of the supervisory positions in joint stock companies. Gordon, 1984, also shows that Jews were vastly overrepresented in the legal and judicial system, among university faculty, and as physicians. At times, the competitive benefit of Jewish group membership was decisive. Thus, in attempting to account for the almost complete absence of Gentile banking enterprises in Prussia in the late 19th century, Mossy emphasizes the competitive advantage enjoyed by Jewish banking firms resulting from the patronage of the Rothschilds, who provided them with capital and higher credit ratings. Jewish banks also had a competitive advantage because, as emphasized in Chapter 6, they were able to take advantage of international Jewish contracts which were not available to their Gentile competitors. In the era after 1900, all of the large joint stock banks had a prominent representation of Jews on their boards of directors. The result was the development of a separate Jewish sector, quote-unquote, of the German economy, in which there were, quote, virtually two separate economies. Mossy, or Mossa. In German, the E on the end would be Mossa. However, the largest overrepresentation of Jews in Germany during this period was in the media, the theater, arts, film, and journalism. The lying professions, let's say. In Berlin in 1930, fully 80% of the theater directors were Jewish, and Jews wrote 75% of the plays produced. Jews edited the leading newspapers and were vastly overrepresented among journalists. Not surprisingly, average Jewish income was considerably higher than average Gentile income, with tax return data suggesting that the Jewish-Gentile income ratio was at least 2-1, and more probably in the range of 4-1. This prosperity was associated with higher aggregate reproductive success than the Gentile population. In the period from 1820 to 1871 in Germany, the Jewish population increased faster than the Christian population, 74% to 63%, despite the fact that Jews entered the demographic transition a full generation earlier than the rest of Germany. Jews had a lower fertility than Christians, and the men married later, but marriage restrictions on the Jews had been lifted, and the infant mortality rate among Jews was lower. Jewish economic success was associated with anti-Semitism throughout Europe. Lindemann describes the, quote, rise of the Jews during the 19th century in Europe as a necessary condition for the modern forms of anti-Semitism that began to appear in the latter part of the century. Remember, they coined the term anti-Semitism to get at the racial aspect of Jews as distinct from the Catholic traditional religious difference with them, although it's a poorly chosen term in my view. Lindemann shows that Jews were encroaching on traditional economic and social areas that were formerly exclusively Christian, that Jews were vastly overrepresented in professional occupations, which represented a common means of upward mobility for Jews and Gentiles, and that they had attained considerable political influence, thereby diminishing the power and control emanating from traditional sources. There is evidence that anti-Semitism in Germany in the period after 1870 was strongest among those most in competition with Jews. Bracher, B-R-A-C-H-E-R, makes the general statement that in the period following 1870, quote, anti-Semitism as a separate movement or as part of an increasingly popular race theory generally flared up in times of economic and political crisis. But to me, this is a lie that Jews have always told, that the opposition to them is economic. You can even find people like Twain saying that. But Americans have never really been particularly greedy because, oh, these people are rich and jealous of them. They're not really like that. If you have freedom, you can make your own riches. But the real dislike of the Jews has sprung from their behavior and what they do to wreck the culture. And that's what drove the Nazis, and that's what drove... They eventually get to where they pollute and corrupt the money, and that's what ultimately... It's not what gives them the power. Their racial loyalty is what is their ultimate set of power. But translating that into the real world, it takes the form of media control and money control. And when they monopolize those areas, they have an infinite... basically a license for infinite power. Because of the way people are biologically, they have to work to get money, and they have to believe what they're told by authority generally. So if someone has control of those two things, the rest of the people are quickly going to be turned into slaves. And that is what has happened. So again, anti-Semitism as a separate movement or as part of an increasingly popular race theory. And again, you remember Charles Darwin, the second half, Herbert Spencer applying that to politics, the competition, survival of the fittest, competition of the races. All these things are going on at the same time as the Industrial Revolution, the liberation of the Jews, granting them full rights. So all these things work together. Generally flared up in times of economic and political crisis. Gordon notes that it is difficult to reject these economic differences out of hand as non-existent or unimportant, and they probably continue to contribute to anti-Semitism because they fostered group tensions. Quote, Massing shows that a concern with disproportionate Jewish representation in education and the occupational profile of Jews was a common ingredient of the wave of racial anti-Semitism that occurred among urban Germans during the period from 1870 to 1895. Remember, he said Jews were fully liberated in 1870. The anti-Semitic press and anti-Semitic politicians routinely called attention. So there's a period between Jews being liberated and they're completely taken over the media where you're free to criticize them and can't be fired for it. The anti-Semitic press and anti-Semitic politicians routinely called attention to Jewish overrepresentation in higher education, business, and the professions, and to their underrepresentation among artisans and farmers. Their agitation struck a responsive chord among the upwardly mobile members of the German lower middle classes. Block quote. Insecurity and instability were the dominant notes of their existence. Taking advantage of easier access to higher education, members of the lower middle classes vigorously pushed their way up into the new occupations, which had only a limited absorptive capacity. Competition was bitterly intense, and the competitors were frequently Jewish. That aspirants from the lower middle classes were particularly sensitive to this fact is testified to by numerous recurring complaints about the disproportionately high ratio of Jewish high school pupils and university students, lawyers, and physicians. That's from Massing. Calls for restrictions on the economic and political roles of Jews were characteristic of the many unsuccessful anti-Semitic political movements dating from the 19th century in Germany. Gordon notes that during the Nazi era, quote, the majority of Germans appear to approve the nonviolent exclusion of Jews from German life, as indicated by their general acceptance of quotas, the elimination of Jews from the civil service and the professions, and the Nuremberg Laws, which penalized sexual contact between Jews and Gentiles. This general approval of nonviolent exclusion is highly compatible with a widespread concern among Germans about Jewish competition. So they didn't necessarily want to kill them, but they wanted to keep them out of German life. And essentially put things the way they had been, where they're living separately. Anti-Semitism was typically more characteristic of the lower middle class and urban petty bourgeoisie in Western and Central Europe, while in Eastern Europe, anti-Semitism also occurred among the gentry threatened by the rise of the Jews. In the former areas, anti-Semitism was most common among artisans, clerks, shopkeepers threatened by Jewish-owned department stores, and those who felt deprived of the opportunity of upward mobility because of Jewish overrepresentation in professional schools. On the other hand, Lindemann notes that anti-Semitism was relatively muted in Hungary, where the native middle and lower classes were small, so the arrival of Jews did not displace an already existing group. However, as Jews began to dominate economic life in Hungary and increasingly bought up land previously owned by the aristocracy and gentry, anti-Semitism became more common among these classes as well, and there were efforts to halt Jewish immigration from Russia. In Russia, restrictions on Jews were justified by the authorities because they feared the Slavic peasants could not compete with the Jews in the newly industrializing economy. Fears made more intense because of the tremendous growth in Jewish population in the 19th century. Jews were viewed as more intelligent, more educated, and more able to compete economically than the mass of Russians by a broad range of political opinion, with the result that the authorities viewed completely free economic competition with considerable trepidation. Quote, there was, in short, a rather widespread consensus in Russia that Jews were a separate, somehow superior race, stubbornly resisting assimilation, and steadily working to dominate those among whom they lived. Certainly true. The Russian pogroms of 1881 were associated with Jewish population growth and increased Jewish immigration into towns, and some of the rioting was instigated by businessmen attempting to compete with Jews. Later, there was competition between middle-class Jews and Gentiles in Russia, so that by the turn of the century, as in Western Europe, modern racist anti-Semitism linked to nationalism seems to have been most pronounced in those urban areas where elements of the Jewish and Gentile middle classes found themselves in harsh competition. It's Lindemann. Anti-Semitism was relatively muted in France, where, despite the rapid rise of a Jewish bourgeoisie and a somewhat more rapid population rise than for the population as a whole, the Jewish population never exceeded 0.2% of the total, so a fifth of 1%. Germany, they're not even 1%. In France, they're a fifth of a percent. Nevertheless, Jews were overrepresented in the professions, finance, middle and top-level government positions, academia in the military, and as students at elite secondary schools. Anti-Semitism occurred among several groups threatened by this rise, including French Catholics concerned about the decline in political power and patronage associated with their religion. Nationalists concerned about the financial power of Jews as a foreign element, often with German origins. Shopkeepers and small businessmen threatened by larger stores or factories disproportionately owned by Jews, and butchers in direct competition with Jews. The relative success of Jews was psychologically very salient to the French. Salient means outstanding, noticeable, sticking out, essentially. A successful Jewish student, Julian Benda, B-E-N-D-A, recalled that his triumph in the Concours Général appeared to me one of the essential sources of the anti-Semitism we had to bear 15 years later. They hate us because we're successful. Whether the Jews realized it or not, such success was felt by other French people as an act of violence. quoted in Johnson, 1987. Finally, Lindemann stresses that the rise of Jews in 19th century Europe was not only a matter of increased wealth and social prestige, but also involved a population explosion, especially in Eastern Europe. As indicated below, the rate of population increase among Jews during this period in Eastern Europe was much higher than that of the non-Jewish populations, i.e., as a community, they had greater reproductive success. The result was that there was increasing social differentiation within the Jewish population, including considerable poverty, as well as emigration to Western Europe and America, especially in the late 1870s and 1880s. Lindemann emphasizes the contribution of the population explosion of Jews in Eastern Europe, e.g. Russia, to anti-Semitism in Western Europe that was inundated by Jewish immigrants. So they're really, their population is exploding, but they're also getting Jews from Eastern Europe coming into Western Europe. There were large population movements within countries from rural to urban areas. After emancipation in Austria, a great many Jews from rural areas settled in Vienna, leading to Gentile perceptions of an invasion by an alien group, especially because Gentiles were being driven out of their occupations by this large group of immigrants. Gay notes that, feeling beleaguered by this ever-growing Jewish presence, Austrian Gentiles worried over it in humor magazines, social clubs, and political meetings. They made anxious jokes, pleaded for the assimilation of the alien invaders, or some of them issued strident calls for their expulsion. Close quote. Before concluding this section, it is worth making a brief comment on Jewish-Gentile competition in the United States in the early 20th century. As noted above in the case of France, there was concern that Jews would, quote, overrun prestigious private universities if intellectual merit were the only criterion. As a result, quota systems were developed to restrict Jewish competition, not only in private universities, but also in professional schools, although in most cases the percentage of Jewish students was still well above their representation in the population. As expected, the diminished resources available during the Great Depression exacerbated these attempts to limit Jewish access to elite schools and high-status professions, or indeed other jobs. Numerical quotas in the professions became more restrictive, and employment advertisements carried an unprecedented number of restrictions on Jews. These quotas were lifted following World War II, and by 1952, Jews constituted 24% of the students at Harvard, 23% at Cornell, 20% at Princeton, and 13% at Yale, despite constituting only 3% of the population. Citing Sachar, S-A-C-H-A-R, 1992. There are a high number of Jews very rapidly achieved a highly disproportionate representation in several key areas of American society in the post-World War II era, and especially after 1960. Rothman and Lichter, 1982, summarized data on the extraordinary representation of Jews in the American Academy in the 1960s and 70s. A 1968 survey found that 20% of the faculty at prestigious schools were Jewish. 20%, they found in 1968, were Jewish. And there was a strong concentration in the social sciences, with fully 30% of the most productive faculty in social science departments at elite universities being Jewish. Similarly, Jews constituted 20% of the legal profession during this period and represented fully 38% of the faculty at elite law schools. Sachar notes that in 1957, Jews constituted 32 of the 70 most eminent intellectuals in a list compiled by Public Interest, and in 1973, Jews were overrepresented by 70% in the Directory of American Scholars. More informally, Patai and Patai, 1989, found that in 1972, 6.5% of a sample from Who's Who in America were Jewish, although they represented only 2.7% of the population. Similarly, Weil, W-E-Y-L, using the Jewish last name method, found Jews overrepresented on several indices of achievement, including Who's Who in America, American Men and Women of Science, Frontier Science and Technology, Poor's Directory of Directors, Who's Who in Finance and Industry, Directory of Medical Specialists, and Who's Who in American Law. Rothman and Lichter note that academic social science departments are an important source of social influence, and this disproportionate Jewish influence on society extended also to the media during this period. A quarter of the Washington Press Corps were found to be Jewish in a 1976 study. So 25% in 76. And 58% of the television news producers and editors at the ABC television network in a 1973 study were Jewish. A 1979 study found that Jewish background was characteristic of 27% of the staff at the most influential news media. During this period, half of primetime television writers were Jewish, and 32% of influential media critics were Jewish. Jewish representation in academia and the media may well have increased in recent times. Ginsburg notes that as of 1993, the percentages of Jewish representation at elite academic institutions were undoubtedly higher than in the late 1960s. Ginsburg also states that despite the fact that Jews comprised only 2% of the population, almost half of American billionaires were Jews, as were approximately 10% of the members of the U.S. Congress. Jewish overrepresentation continues to be apparent in the media. Kotkin notes that, quote, the role of Jews within Hollywood and the related entertainment field remains pervasive. Ginsburg notes that the owners of the largest newspaper chain and the most influential newspaper, the New York Times, are Jews, as are the chief executive officers of the three major television networks and the four largest film studios. Rothman and Lichter's conclusion would appear to be accurate. Americans of Jewish background have become an elite group in American society with a cultural and intellectual influence far beyond their numbers. Flipping over to page 198, new subtitle. Reproductive competition between Jews and Gentiles. As noted above, Beinart, B-E-I-N-A-R-T, cites the view of historian Andres Bernaldez, who, writing during the period of the Inquisition, noted that the purpose of the crypto-Jews was to, quote, increase and multiply, close quote, a comment that clearly indicates that the old Christians were concerned about reproductive competition between themselves and the crypto-Jews of the 15th century. Baer, B-A-E-R, 1961, points to the increasing Jewish population as well as the concomitant social differentiation and class conflict among Jews from the late 13th to the 15th century. Baer writes a 14th century observer. Baer cites a 14th century observer who noted that whereas previously the Jews were few in number and wealthy, there was now a great deal of social differentiation within the Jewish community, and the Jewish quarter was densely populated. There's a lot more Jews, and some of them are poorer. Baer also infers an increasing Jewish population from the development in the 13th century of a growing class struggle and from the growth of executive bodies within Jewish communities. Roth, 1937, mentions their rapidly increasing descendants in the 15th century prior to the Inquisition, and Leah, L-E-A, 1906-07, notes that the number of Jews increased, quote, until they formed a notable portion of the population. Nevertheless, although there is agreement that the Jewish population was increasing rapidly prior to the expulsion, I have been unable, says McDonald, to find explicit comparisons between Jewish and Christian population changes in pre-expulsion Spain. Hilgarth, 1978, notes that there are no good population estimates for Castile before 1528, but suggests that the population of Aragon, these are Spanish provinces essentially. Hilgarth notes that there are no good ones for Castile before 1528, but suggests that the population of Aragon did not grow in the period from 1300 to 1500 and may have actually decreased. A finding that, given the Jewish demographic data discussed above, would indicate that the Jewish population increased at a greater rate than did the Gentile population during this period. There is widespread agreement that at least until the demographic transition, Jews in Eastern Europe had a much greater rate of natural increase than the Gentile populations. He cites Deschen, D-E-S-H-E-N. See also Ritterband, Goldstein. Johnson, 1987, notes that in the period of 1880 to 1914, the Jewish population of Europe grew at a rate of 2% a year. Quote, a rate of increase that exceeds all other European peoples for this period. So the Jews are really, really profiting and benefiting, getting richer and more numerous in the Industrial Revolution and in the liberation that Napoleon set up for them. For Poland, Abramski, Jakimczyk, and Polanski, see also Hundert multiple times, find that the percentage of Jews in Poland increased from 0.6% at the end of the 15th century, remember they were in Poland about 800 years, to 5% by the mid-17th century. So they're less than 1%, they go 10 times larger to 5% in mid-17th century, and to 10% by 1920. So their percentage of the population goes from under one, from half a percent to 10% over hundreds of years by 1920. Similarly, in Russia, from 1820 to 1880, the Jewish population increased by 150%, while the non-Jewish population increased only 87%. The increase in certain areas was even more remarkable, e.g., by increasing by 850% from 1844 to 1914 in the southern provinces, compared to 250% for non-Jews. And most of the increase was in urban areas. The phenomenon of the village Jew, occurring in the 16th to the 18th century in Poland, suggests that the Jews had reached the limit of the urban economy during this period, with the result that there was increasing colonization outside the traditional Jewish urban economic sphere. On the basis of Polish data, Plakans, P-L-A-K-A-N-S, and Halpern attribute greater Jewish fertility primarily to the young age at which females married and to the fact that virtually all females married. Both of these attributes of Jewish families contrast strongly with the general European pattern in which significant numbers of females remained unmarried during times of economic hardship. Since the usual interpretation of the European pattern of delayed marriage and female celibacy reflects economic constraints, e.g. Wrigley and Schofield, 1981, the results suggest that there were fewer economic constraints on Jews regarding marriage than was the case for Gentiles. However, there are also indications that the mortality rate, the death rate, among Jews was significantly lower than that for surrounding populations, like fewer of their babies are dying. Gittleman. A finding related to the high investment parenting typical of most Jewish communities throughout history. It is quite possible that anti-Semitism has been a significant factor in Jewish demographic history. Although Jews appear to have had a more rapid rate of increase in Spain prior to the Inquisition and expulsion, the ultimate result of the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion was probably far different, since the great majority of the Sephardic refugees eventually ended up in the Muslim world, where there was a long-term demographic and cultural decline of Judaism resulting ultimately from anti-Semitism on the part of the local populations. So the Jews were expelled, they went to Muslim areas, and they experienced demographic decline because the locals in the Muslim areas didn't like them. Freikorps describes the boom and bust nature of Ashkenazi population growth, growing quickly due to very high fecundity, but then dropping back as the result of persecution and massacre. As reconstructed by Freikorps, F-R-A-I-K-O-R, as reconstructed by Freikorps, the Ashkenazi population increased rapidly until the period of the Crusades, when anti-Semitic massacres and expulsions occurred throughout Western Europe, with the Jewish population reaching a low point in the 14th century. This was followed by a rapid rise during the Golden Age of the Jews in Poland, followed by a demographic crash as a result of the Cossack massacres and other wars in the 17th century. This pattern has continued into the 20th century, and not only with the Nazi Holocaust. Gittleman notes that in Russia, the events from 1914 to 1945, including over 2,000 pogroms between 1918 to 1921, and the Stalinist purges of the 1930s, had a devastating demographic effect on Jews. A particularly interesting Gentile response to reproductive competition with Jews in traditional societies was to place restrictions on the fertility of the Jewish population. This appears to have been particularly common in Germany. Lowenstein describes regulations in parts of pre-emancipation Germany that prescribed the number of Jewish families in each town was not to increase and that Jews could not settle in other towns without special permission. Families could only be started if there was an emigration or death of a head of a household. However, exceptions were made in the case of wealthy merchants or industrialists, craftsmen, and farmers. Alice Goldstein, writing on the basis of 18th century German data, finds communities restricting marriage to only one child per family and restricting the number of marriages per year out of fear, quote, that the Jews would become too populous and then too powerful. These laws continued in some parts of Germany in the 19th century and were especially strong in Bavaria, where the population of Jews decreased from 52,000 to 50,000 in the period from 1818 to 1871. There was some indication that these legal restrictions resulted in the later age of marriage in these areas than in areas without the restrictions. In some areas, however, illegal marriages and high rates of illegitimacy occurred as a result of the restrictions. These data clearly indicate that resource and reproductive competition occurred between Jews and Gentiles in traditional societies. In at least some cases, there is very good evidence that Jews won this competition, especially by squeezing out competitors in the urban economy, i.e. the economy that was midway between the primary production of the peasantry and the ruling Gentile elite. Moreover, there is evidence that Jewish population growth, undoubtedly in conjunction with Jewish control of economic resources, was viewed negatively by Gentile communities and was associated with attempts to control the Jewish population, as well as attempts to limit Jewish control of resources, which made possible the Jewish demographic increases. So it's a zero-sum game. Either Gentiles have the control and the money or Jews do. Finally, the generalization that the rate of population increase among Jews was higher than that of Gentiles in many traditional societies and the industrializing societies of Eastern and Central Europe does not extend beyond those societies. Data reviewed in Chapter 7 indicate a decline in Jewish fertility in contemporary Western societies to a level below that of Gentiles. That ends the text of the chapter, and we've got the notes. Notes in SAID. I develop a theory of anti-Semitism based on social identity theory. From this theoretical perspective, resource competition is expected to exacerbate anti-Semitism, but other factors, e.g. cultural separatism, are expected to be important as well. So there's 36 total notes. 2, during the Civil War leading to the Magna Carta, Jews were often the first target of the aristocratic forces, and the Magna Carta itself contains two clauses that restrict the lending practices of Jews by ensuring that widows and orphans had first claim on the estate before debts owed to Jews. In the following period, Jews were tolerated only if they could show that they were of financial benefit to the king, and when, as a result of royal depredations of Jewish wealth, this ceased to be the case, the Jews were expelled entirely. Jordan indicates that Christian merchants were also instrumental in the expulsion of the Jews as a means of removing a source of competition. 3. A tax farmer is one who promises to pay the government authorities a certain sum for the right to collect taxes in a particular area. 4. Although these data suggest resource competition between overseas Chinese and host populations, Zenner also notes that the Chinese did not maintain a rigid cultural or reproductive barriers between themselves and the host society in Taiwan, Indonesia, etc. Or Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, etc. There are other indications that the overseas Chinese did not really constitute a closed group strategy. Thus, the evidence that Chinese merchants favored friends and relatives is compatible with essentially individual/family strategies, where the Chinese businessman conceptualizes his relationships in terms of kinship and reciprocity, rather than in an in-group, out-group manner, where the in-group includes all diaspora Chinese. So the Chinese are maybe superficially a little bit like Jews and being interloper aliens in other lands who are benefiting economically over the natives, but they're actually doing kinship family stuff, not true, pure Jewish in-group, out-group, dual code stuff. Also compatible with this interpretation is Zenner's comment that the Chinese was the extended family unit, as indicated by ancestor worship as the primary religious manifestation. Jews, on the other hand, developed a highly elaborated diaspora ideology in which the locus of group identification included all members of the dispersed group, no matter how distantly related. One's family was simply a part of this much larger group, or the larger group, the Tenors. Reflecting this group, rather than a familial sense of identification, Jews typically communicated regularly and often engaged in altruistic behavior toward co-religionists in distant parts of the world. This did not occur with the Chinese. So that's a very useful footnote in pointing out the difference between Chinese and Jews. The family is key in China more than the race. The race is important, but it's less important than the family and the kinship group, as he's calling it, extended. 5. The Jews were also viewed as indispensable to the Muslim rulers of Spain, even during periods characterized by considerable anti-Semitism. Fischel notes that despite many de jure, that is, legal restrictions on Jews during the Abbasid Caliphate, Jews were utilized in the civil services where their services were indispensable, especially in the roles of physician and banker. So they're doctors and bankers to the Muslim rulers as they were to the Spanish rulers as well. 6. The Jews were well aware of the protection provided by the king and grateful for it. Baer notes that laws on Jewish informers generally prohibited actions that would benefit Christians. The exception, however, was the king. Quote, if anyone would tell the king, whom God save, or the lords of council a thing to his, the king's advantage, and for his well-being, even if the information was directed against a Jew, that man shall not be stigmatized as an informer or slanderer, since all Jews are in duty bound to seek the king's welfare. 7. Many Jews were forced to convert to Christianity as a result of the riots of 1391. Now, E. Michael Jones would make it clear that, you know, forced conversions are not allowed, but he's really using that pretty loosely in terms of saying they're not forced. Well, if you're going to die or choose it, I guess it's freely chosen, but, you know, you're kind of making a joke out of it if you're saying it's voluntary when the other alternative is being killed, right? Forced converts, so MacDonald says overtly that they were forced. Forced converts and their descendants are termed conversos, or new Christians, or sometimes the derogatory Muranos, which I think means pigs, or sheep, or something, in contrast to Gentiles, or old Christians, or real Christians. 8. Brief mention should be made regarding Jewish competition with Gentiles in the Muslim world. Stillman notes the exclusion of Jews from a wide range of economic activities by Muslim guilds in medieval Morocco and from government service in 14th century Egypt. In Morocco, Jews were restricted to certain crafts and money lending, which were prohibited or viewed negatively by Muslims for religious reasons, and Sephardic Jews, Jewish artisans, formed their own guilds and professional societies there. A commentary on the Jews of Tunis in the late 19th century notes that Jews were displacing Arabs in trade and industry because they were protected by the authorities. Their newly acquired status enabled the Jews to successfully compete with the native Arab population and resulted in fear and jealousy by the displaced Arabs. Quote, this fear and jealousy is added to the hatred of centuries in the old Dishifa ben Dishifa, Carian, sons of Carian. Jews are called by the Muslims Dishifa, D-S-H-I-F-A. Is still the usual designation when they speak of Jews, and maybe we should rehabilitate that to Shifa, Carrion. 9. As said in SAID, Separation and Its Discontents, the converso community remained highly cohesive and endogamous, that means marrying within its own self, over a time span of several hundred years. So they converted, well, in name, but not in reality. Many of its members became crypto-Jews, often openly returning to Judaism after emigrating from the Iberian Peninsula. 10. Even after the establishment of the Inquisition and well into the 16th century, the conversos retained control of the municipal councils. 11. As discussed in SAID, intermarriage into the nobility tended to occur as a result of Jews providing dowries so that their daughters could marry into the Gentile nobility. Such marriages, therefore, did not affect the racial purity of the Jewish gene pool, since the children were reared as Gentiles. Moreover, there was no intermarriage at all in the lower social classes. 12. These beliefs may well have been exaggerated, but they certainly indicate that perceptions of resource competition were important psychologically to the old Christians. The social identity theory of anti-Semitism developed in SAID in Chapter 1 is highly compatible with the importance of false, exaggerated beliefs in the development of anti-Semitism. 13. As discussed in SAID Chapter 4, racial purity, or limpieza in Spanish, limpia, basically the verb is to clean, limpiarlo, clean it, you know. Racial purity, or limpieza, became a prime consideration for competition for resources during the period of the Inquisition, resulting in upward mobility of the lower classes because they were much less likely to have any Jewish ancestry. 14. The comment is undoubtedly intentionally reminiscent of God's promise to Abraham at Genesis 22:17, quote, "I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore." 15. The persecution, however, occurred within the context of continued new Christian financing of the Spanish monarchy, since there was no effective alternative to new Christian participation in the royal finances. Eventually, however, all except the most powerful new Christians increasingly looked elsewhere for their future and eventually settled in diaspora Portuguese communities and northern mercantile centers such as Amsterdam, where they reverted to their Jewish identity. Yeah, they went to England, they went to Amsterdam, some went to Turkey, and they also went to Portugal. E. Michael Jones talks about a lot of that. 16. The very precisely defined economic roles of Jews in Venice required policing. The main activity of the Inquisition of Venice was to prevent deception by crypto-Jews posing as Christians in order to circumvent the restrictions on Jewish economic activity. Crypto-Jews who declared their Judaism upon entering Venice did not come under the purview of the Inquisition. But individuals were investigated if they were believed to have remained crypto-Jews in Venice and continued to conduct business as Christians. 17. Concern with Jewish ties to the Turks is an example of the loyalty issue, a consistent theme of anti-Semitism, that Jews are only loyal to themselves. 18. The only exception was the wine business, which was perhaps due to ritual reasons. However, Jews were active in the wine business in other areas of Poland. 19. Massey also describes intense competition in the wire-making industry between a Jewish group and a Gentile firm, which eventually resulted in amalgamation. However, he points to a continuing ethnic aspect of the episode. The Jewish group, although unrelated, retained its central core of Jewish managers over four generations and retained close commercial ties with other Jewish firms. Similar examples are discussed in Chapter 6. 20. For example, in 1931, of the 100 largest companies, 31 were predominantly Jewish, 58 were predominantly Gentile, and only 10 were a mixture. 21. Data summarized by Gay, 1988, indicate a similar pattern in Vienna during this period, where by 1880, Jews made up 10% of the population. There are clear associations between resource competition and the rise of anti-Semitism emanating from the Gentile society. Regarding the extent of Jewish cultural dominance in fin de siècle, end of the century Vienna, Gay quotes the German Jewish novelist Jacob Wasserman as writing that, quote, "Nearly all the people with whom I came into intellectual or cordial contact were Jews. I soon recognized that all public life was dominated by Jews." Again, this is end of the century Vienna. The banks, the press, the theater, literature, social functions, all was in the hands of the Jews, says a German Jew. I guess going to Vienna. 22. In chapter 7, these demographic tendencies among the Jews are viewed as general aspects of Judaism as an evolutionary ecological strategy. 23. As I indicated in note 1, resource competition is not expected to be the only factor involved in anti-Semitism. Gordon notes that German anti-Semitism was strongest in areas with the greatest number of unassimilated Eastern European Jewish immigrants, suggesting an independent effect of negative attitudes engendered by cultural separatism. The restriction of Jewish immigration was a common theme of anti-Semitism in Germany. 24. Katz finds that by 1860, the percentage of Jewish children attending secondary school was 3 to 4 times higher than that of Gentile population, and that this ratio increased in later years. 25. There is no question that Hitler's perception that Jews and, quote, Aryans were locked in an intense competition was central to his worldview. Bracker, Gordon. See discussion in SAID Chapter 5. These perceptions of economic competition and Jewish economic domination, although clearly having a basis in reality, may well have been exaggerated, a not uncommon aspect of anti-Semitism and one that is highly compatible with an evolutionary perspective. However, when the Nazis ultimately achieved power, anti-Semitism became a top-down movement in the sense that its direction was determined by the leaders of the party and was quite independent of popular support. Quote, Nazi victory meant that Hitler and the radical anti-Semites in the Nazi party, not the German electorate in general, would determine Jewish policy. That's Gordon. Last 2 pages now. 26. Carlebach, C-A-R-L-E-B-A-C-H, notes that all classes in Germany, nobility, merchants, small shopkeepers, and laborers, all classes in Germany feared they would be negatively affected by the emancipation of the Jews. Jews established close links with the ruling aristocracy, and the aristocracy often became financially dependent on the Jews. Lindemann. Carlebach also notes that the nobility in Prussia opposed the emancipation of the Jews because they feared that Jews would purchase all of the land. There was no fear that emancipating the Gentile peasants would similarly alter the old social order. 27. These opinions are supported by modern research. See Chapter 7. 28. In addition, Lindemann shows that the Jews were also overrepresented among those responsible for major financial scandals, such as bank failures, large-scale fraud, Bernie Madoff, and stock market panics. These incidents often had disproportionately adverse effects on Gentiles, and Gentiles attributed them to Jews. Although these incidents do not involve direct competition, they do involve an exploitative Jewish-Gentile relationship in the sense that individual Jews were overrepresented among those who benefited by these affairs, so that resources are moving from the Gentile community to the Jewish community without proportionate reciprocity. Again, zero-sum game. Jews and Gentile dealings. 29. For example, while 58% of the graduates of City College of New York who applied to medical school were accepted in 1925, only 15% were accepted in 1939. The percentage of Jews in medical school at Columbia University declined from 47% in 1920 to 8% in 1940. Dinnerstein. 30. Ginsburg, 1993, shows that Jewish economic and cultural success since 1960 in the United States has the potential to result in anti-Semitic repercussions. For example, Jews were predominant among those involved in hostile corporate takeovers and insider trading scandals during the 1980s, and Gentile reactions to these activities often had anti-Semitic overtones. Moreover, African Americans with the highest level of anti-Semitism are elite professionals who are in competition with Jews for positions in the public and quasi-public sectors of the economy. There are also suggestions that non-Jewish white liberals may sometimes welcome African American anti-Semitism as a means of decreasing Jewish influence. 31. These percentages percentage increases occurred despite the existence of considerable emigration, which began in the 17th century following the Cossack uprisings. 32. Notice that, within this perspective, celibacy does not play an independent role in limiting population growth among Gentiles. Rises in celibacy are a result of economic constraints. 33. In at least one instance, greater Jewish fertility occurred despite later marriage. Alice Goldstein finds that, although Jews were indeed more fertile than Gentiles prior to 1880 in a German sample, they actually married later than Gentiles. 34. See chapters 7 and 8 and SAID chapter 4. 35. Fracor, 1977, also notes that the plague contributed to the demographic low point in the 14th century. Finally, 36. The latter two categories were encouraged as a part of government policy to get the Jews to adopt these occupations rather than the more typical occupation of petty trade. And that will wrap up today's segment in Chapter 5. And I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of A People That Shall Dwell Alone by Kevin MacDonald. And we will continue and finish the book in sessions to come. This is The Learning College. Find it at vnmforum.com. Also, I will post the links on pyville.net, where you, a social medium that is similar to Twitter and Gab, but perhaps you're allowed to say marginally more things than you are at those fine outlets. Anyway, the basic point here is that Jews and Gentiles are competitive, and Jews have an advantage because they work as a team, and it allows their tiny numbers yet still to dominate. And it's bad for us that they dominate us, and we shouldn't allow them to dominate us. We have the brains to understand what's going on, and if we have the will to change it, we can create a better world for ourselves. And that would be the application of the things that you learn, we learn, and I learned here at Learning College. Thanks for being with me. I'll be back with you again real soon.